Welcome to the 13 Skull. The journey into a world that is just beyond our comprehension. The world of the paranormal.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode number 14 of the 13 Skulls podcast. Today we got a lot of really good stuff for you to cover. We're going to take a look at some listener emails that were sent in. We're also going to be taking a look at Mel's Hole, Project Camelot's interview with Sergeant Clifford Stone about how he went on a crash recovery mission in Vietnam during the 1960s and how he helped an ET to escape from military custody. We're going to take a look at the scariest shadow people stories that I could find, a winged creature in Angol, Chile, and a visit from the devil. And quite a bit more than that. So stay tuned. We got a lot of stuff coming to you in this 14th episode of the 13 Skulls podcast. All right, well, thanks everybody for stopping by. I really do appreciate all the support that everybody's been giving me for keeping the show going. Let's get some of the formality stuff out of the way here. I love to know where people are listening to the show from. So if you want to let me know where you're listening to the show from, sign the Frapper map. You can go to frapper.com and find the 13 Skulls in there, or you can go to the left sidebar of www.the13skulls.com and find the link to the Frapper map there. Because I love to know where people are listening from, so please sign it. I love to know this stuff. It's amazing that, you know, where some people find the show from. But anyway, if you also feel like you like the show enough, give us a vote on Podcast Alley. There is a link on the left sidebar of the13skulls.com to be able to go to the Podcast Alley link and vote for us. Or if you don't feel like going to the site, just go to Podcast Alley and look up the show. It's pretty easy to find. Also, on Ning.com, or Inning, I'm not really sure how to pronounce it still, on the 13 Skulls social network, if that's what you want to call it, you can share pics, audio, video, or whatever else you want to share. You can get the latest shows there as an RSS feed for the show, and you can chat with all the other members and start discussions on the forums and, you know, actually get involved with the society, the network, the whatever you want to call it that's on there. You can also join all kinds of other, Mysterious Universe is on there. There's all kinds of different stuff on there, but, you know, go there and give it a look and, you know, start some discussion with some of the other listeners about the show or whatever you want to talk about. So just go to the13skullspodcast.ning.com, and that's the13skullspodcast.ning.com. I remember in the last episode, I was talking about the Podomatic feed is going to go basic as of April. Well, seeing as how I had already paid for my membership there for the month of April, it's actually not going to go basic to the beginning of May. So you have a little bit longer, which is just a few days away. So that means that really the bandwidth isn't going to be limited until May, but once it is, it's going to be really limited. So change over your fee subscriptions at www.the13skulls.com, and that's THE13SKULLS.com, to be able to get all the upcoming shows and content. That way you don't have to worry about not being able to get the show. The Podomatic feed is going to stay there. So if you want to stay subscribed to it, please, you know, go right ahead. But I suggest, or, you know, I just, you know, do whatever you want, but I suggest going there and, you know, resubscribing to the show. There's plenty of links there to be able to get the show, you know, the feeds and everything. So if you feel like you want to send a comment or experience or whatever you want to the show, you want to write it out or send me an MP3, the email is for the show is the13skulls@gmail.com. Or if you feel like calling the show and leaving a voicemail, the phone numbers are 206-338-2205. Or you can call here locally in the DFW area at 817-986-0019. All right, well, let's go ahead and get right into it because we got a lot of stuff to cover here. And pardon me if for whatever reason I decide to start stumbling on my words here. For some reason, I've had a real issue with being able to talk today. So let's hope that I can keep my tongue from getting tied. The first thing that I want to take a look at is courtesy of Disclose.tv. And if you haven't heard of Disclose.tv, it's a really good site for videos of paranormal and unusual things. It's really cool. You should go there. I'll post a link to it. I'll post a link to all the videos, and I'll actually try and post the videos up there too so you guys can go and actually watch them. But the first one that I wanted to take a look at is a night vision UFO that these guys, I'm not even sure who they are, where they were, or whatever, but they filmed these supposed UFOs with night vision on a camera. And to be honest with you, it's interesting. I mean, you can hear them talking about these aren't supposed to be real, but yet we're catching them on video. You know, they're actually talking about how they're seeing them, and you know, basically they're basically kind of pointing to the fact that, you know, oh well, these aren't supposed to be real. People say they aren't real, but yet we're getting them on video. And it's kind of hard to tell what they're actually looking at. I mean, you do see, it's kind of that green night vision look to it, and I mean, it's interesting, but I wouldn't say it's the best video I've ever seen, because to me, what they're videotaping just kind of look like stars that are out of focus. But I mean, they do actually look like something, but to me, they just look kind of like stars. I don't know. But the guys that are in the video act like they believe what they see, that they're actually seeing something that's a UFO. And they also talk about how, it went thousands of miles across the night sky and space in a matter of seconds. And you know, to be honest with you, a satellite can move across the sky really fast. I've seen satellites in the middle of the night that have done that. So to say that it was a UFO, I don't know. And to be honest with you, what they're describing and what you're seeing, you really don't see anything move, because it looks like he's really zoomed in and trying to focus on something, but he's not doing too good of a job. But anyway, it's interesting. It's an interesting video. You guys should go take a look at it and let me know what you think. The next video that I wanted to take a look at is a USA Air Force UFO footage. And it's interesting. This video is I don't really know what to make of it. It's a really short video. It's kind of grainy, but you can, basically the video is this. You see above, or just above the clouds, an F-16 flying from, supposedly what they're saying is that you see an F-16 flying next to a MiG. And the F-16 is just flying along. You can see the clouds moving in the background. And it's kind of grainy, but you can see the UFO off in the distance come into the frame. And it's just this black little fuzzy thing that comes into the frame. And you can see it go behind some clouds. Then you see it emerge back out as the planes are flying. You can only see one plane. You can't see the whole thing. You can just see part of it. But the image, whatever it is, UFO, this little black dot, starts heading down into the clouds. And as it's getting closer to the clouds, you can actually see the shadow of whatever it is moving across the clouds. And as it gets closer, the shadow meets with the image as it goes into the clouds. It's really interesting. I mean, you can actually see the shadow of the object on the clouds. Now, that's not to say somebody can't Photoshop that or hoax it in some way, but it was an interesting video because it's supposed to be military footage, I guess. But anyway, you know, it's an interesting video. You guys should go take a look at it. It's not that long. It only takes a few seconds to get through. And, you know, again, it's courtesy of Disclose.tv. I'll post links to it. I'll actually try and embed the videos into the website so you guys can take a look at it straight from the13skulls.com. Well, the next one that I wanted to take a look at is called The Crying Ghost. And it's interesting. You might want to turn up the volume whenever you watch this one because it's kind of light. You can't really hear a whole lot. The guy doesn't really talk too loud. But it's in this person's house, apartment, whatever it is, and he's heading to the door because he says he hears something. I don't know if he's talking to somebody else or if he's talking to the camera, you know, to talk to the people who are, you know, listening to it later on. But he walks across the room and slowly opens up this door that leads into a hallway of some kind, or maybe even another bedroom. he opens up the door, and as the light shines in, you can see something that's kind of balled up kind of in the corner. The room almost looks like it kind of goes down about 10 or 15 feet and then turns to the right. And it looks like there's something crouched down, or maybe a coat piled up in the corner of the about 10 feet in front of him. But you can't really tell what it is. And then you hear a baby cry, or something that sounds like a baby crying. Well, I guess he gets freaked out and he shuts the door. So he decides to go back. Well, when he goes back, he opens up the door again and focuses back in. When he focuses back in on where that one thing was, you can see this shadow standing there with its distinct human figure, arms hanging down separate from the body. You can see him. It's giving me kind of chills just thinking of it right now whenever I watched it earlier, but it's kind of a creepy video. It doesn't last for very long either. And, you know, it's just creepy because he goes up there. You can hear the baby crying, almost like a baby balled up in the corner. And when he goes back and opens the door again, it's a full-figured shadow person. I mean, who's to say it might actually be a hoax? Might possibly could be his own shadow of some kind. I don't know. But when he opens up the door, he goes around. It's standing there while the camera is moving. I don't know. I wouldn't think that it was his shadow. But then again, who's to say it wasn't, you know, hoaxed of some kind? It wasn't photoshopped of some kind. But anyway, I thought it was an interesting video, along with the night vision UFOs in the U.S., the Air Force video. I thought they were interesting. Again, I'll post those up. You guys can go take a look at them. If you've got any feedback on them, you know, let me know what you think. All right, well, I wanted to talk about some of the listener emails that I got recently, and the first one that I wanted to talk about is from Neil, and he emailed me a time before, and he was from the THAAD project, the High Altitude Aerial Defense Project, I believe is what it stood for. Well, he wrote me another email, which I thought was really interesting, and I wanted to share it with you guys. He says, I got a chance to have a wonderful conversation with my friend who formerly worked at Area 51 during an open bar party paid by Lockheed. We started talking about aircraft that he had worked with back in the early 70s. I didn't really understand a lot of the technical specs that he was throwing at me, but basically these aircraft were ahead of their time, and they were testing several craft with anti-gravity propulsion systems powered by some type of nuclear reaction. I had never seen him drink before, and I could tell he really didn't do it often because I think he finally realized days later that he shouldn't have been disclosing that many details to me. Another interesting bit was the fact that the hangars that these craft were stored in resided on the inside of a mountain. The hangar doors were actually camouflaged to look like rocks, and when closed, nobody could tell from the ground or from overhead what was hidden inside. I believe he said there were 9 of these total, although he didn't say all the aircraft, say they had aircraft in all of them, so they could have had some of them were, you know, could have been empty. The most interesting part of the night came from him disclosing his getting to work every day and constant moving they had him do. He mostly traveled by air from Las Vegas International white Boeing 737. So a plain old white Boeing 737. He would sometimes stay at work for days and other times go home later at night. He moved constantly from several different suburbs of Los Angeles or Las Vegas. Every time he moved, the new house or apartment was fully furnished, including TV, bed, and all the clothes he could ever need. He also had his own driver and kept saying he had to be on his toes because Big Brother, in quotes, was everywhere and they were constantly keeping an eye on him when he was out around town. He had to let the hire know when he was leaving, where he was going, and when he was expected to return. So basically, he had to disclose everything he was doing all the time. He had to tell him when he was going to poop, when he was going to pee. Maybe not that extent, but you know what I mean. Well, that's all about all I can remember. I was pretty sloshed that night as well, but it was great talking to him again. I don't know if I believe all the stuff he has told me or not, but he has no reason to lie to me, and he has the respect of the world from all of his coworkers. I thought it was really interesting to know that there were bases or hangars inside of a mountain, which I'd heard that before, but coming from somebody that used to work at Area 51, kind of, it's pretty interesting. Now, granted, the guy was drunk. I do have to admit, he could have easily been making things up, but I know that at least for myself and a lot of people that I know, when you're drunk, the truth kind of comes out. So maybe he really was telling the truth. You never know. I mean, he very well could have been. But the next things that I thought were interesting, that he would have his apartments fully furnished with TV, bed, all the clothes he would ever need, which is interesting. I mean, there seems to be a lot of setup that you would need to do to get clothes for somebody, considering the certain sizes people are. He also had his own driver and kept saying that he had to keep on his toes because Big Brother was everywhere and was constantly keeping an eye on him. So maybe they had people out there, you know, keeping an eye on him, or maybe there's a lot of video cameras and surveillance that we don't know about that's going on around there. I thought it was an interesting story. He said he had never seen a craft like the caller from Texas spoke about in the last episode, Dennis, I believe it was, but he has seen several bright colored orbs and weird lights that he had spoke about in some of his previous emails. And he said that when he was younger, around 12, his family and himself saw a big bright object in the Southern California sky. We all gathered in the car and tried to follow it up a rural mountain road. We all had no idea in the world what it was, and we were all fascinated by it. Well, all of a sudden, the orb zipped off at an amazing speed, leaving behind a contrail that had some very weird colors in it. At this time, it was becoming dark, and the trail eventually faded off. He tried to talk to his parents about this event, and both of them saying they had no idea what he was talking about. They don't remember anything like that ever happening, which is strange. I mean, maybe whatever it was, you know, maybe his parents, or Neil, maybe your parents were just trying to, you know, keep you from getting scared about what you saw as a kid by saying they didn't really, you know, didn't see it. But at the same time, I've heard some people saying that whenever they saw a UFO, that there was something that happened that kept them from being able to remember it. Like they erased their memory, or maybe they did something to make them, you know, forget about what happened. And maybe since you were a child at the time, around 12, it's my personal belief that children can recover from things quite a bit faster than adults can, physically and mentally. I think they can recover from them quite a bit faster. So maybe it's the fact that you were 12 whenever it happened that you were able to remember it. Maybe they tried to get you to forget about it, but you know, your mind was young and resilient and came back and you know, you could remember all that stuff. Either way, I thought it was interesting that he, you know, that Neil, I had to say first that I'm really jealous of the fact that you got somebody to talk to that used to work at Area 51. I thought that was just phenomenal. I would love to be able to talk to somebody who has actually worked at Area 51, even if they, you know, would deny everything that I, you know, if I ever brought it up and they would deny everything, then, you know, that's fine. But just be able to talk to one of them and hear just even little things about it would be just be great. Well, thanks anyway, Neil. I really do appreciate you sending that in. The next email is from Steve, who did all the photo analysis on the building that had the images in the window, you know, the one that my supervisor Kim had sent to me, the ones of that one building that had all the orbs in it and all the creepy weird you know, tape and things. Anyway, he sent in the pictures that had the analysis on it that he did, and I'll post those up for you guys. But his email said, just listening to episode 13, I'm glad you liked the analysis. Here are the images that I used to include, are included in the original, and they're enlarged original with brightness increased and the anomalies highlighted. And he says that your comment about feeling like a Kennedy candy store really sums up how I feel about the paranormal. Every story fills me with a sense that the world is full of strange, mysterious things that we haven't even begun to understand. It's the same feeling that I used to get whenever I was a kid looking through every book on the paranormal that I could get my hands on. Well, I'm the same way, Steve, and thanks for sending in the pictures. You got full credit for doing the work on those, and I will share them with everybody and see if I can get any feedback or opinions on those. I really do appreciate it, and I feel the same way. I'm like a kid in a candy store when it comes to the paranormal. I absolutely love it, and it's just great. It's phenomenal. I love it. So thanks, Steve, for sending that in, and everybody go take a look at the pictures that Steve sent. I'll post those up. You guys can go take a look at them and let us know what you think. And you know, if you got any ideas on it, if you did any of your own you know, your own analysis on it, let me know. And the next email that I wanted to take a look at is courtesy of Chris. And Chris said, hey, I just wanted to let you know that I really love your podcast. I live in Arlington, which is no more than 5 minutes from here, and have always been interested in the bizarre and paranormal, but have never really done anything more than look stuff up online. Your show has changed that. Now I'm wanting to go out and try to see any experiences and get, you know, have experiences for himself. And you also said that I also want to like to maybe help you out if you could use extra hands on any investigations. Well, Chris, I tell you what, since you live right here in Arlington, I do. There's a couple of places that I'm planning on going to that, you know, it's taking seemingly forever to be able to be able to go to these places. Some of them is just the fact that the owners won't let me. But anyway, yeah, dude, I tell you what, if I happen to be going up there anytime, I will let you know. I'll shoot you an email in plenty of time and let you know the date and when and where and all that stuff. So thanks for sending that in, Chris. I really do appreciate it. The next email is from Rocky. He says, hi, TJ. I just wanted to send an email and let you know I think your show is one, if not the best out there, which thank you. I really do appreciate that. I don't know if I can take credit for the best podcast out there, but I appreciate your thoughts anyway. There are so many now, and most of them are junk shows, as I call them. Some are doing okay, and some seem to do a good job, but most just take up time for nothing. I have to say that I can hardly wait till each show comes out. I check your site every day or so to make sure that I don't miss one, but in a good it says, yes, you have me hooked, but in a good way. So keep doing whatever you're doing because you've done what most will never do. And thank you. I really do appreciate that, Rocky, man. I'll tell you what, to be able to get emails like that is just, it's something that motivates me to keep doing the show. And I apologize that I can't do the show every day. I would love to be able to do the show every day, but I don't get paid for it. Got to have a normal job. So, you know, shows come out whenever they can. But I appreciate the feedback, you guys. I really do appreciate the fact that you enjoy listening to the show. And, you know, it makes me feel good. It makes me motivated to keep doing it, which is why I'm sitting down right here, you know, recording right now. So anyway, thanks, you guys. Rocky, Chris, Neil, Steve, thanks for sending those in. I really do appreciate it. And the next email is a great story sent in by Samantha, and I have to share this with you guys. The email says, hi, my name is Samantha, writing from Florida. I recently heard about the 13 Skulls, and I really love listening to it. You're one of my favorite podcast hosts, and your show is such a great mixture of information and entertainment. Great job. I wanted to share my ghost story with you. Most people I've told about it just think I'm crazy. I thought I might try my luck with you. Well, I won't think you're crazy, because I have stories out there that a lot of people have called me crazy for that I know I'm not. So I won't call you crazy, Samantha, not at all. I would never call anybody here crazy unless you did something to make me mad, which any of the listeners out there, I doubt you can. But anyway, her email goes on to say, it says, I was 16 at the time, so this happened about 6 years ago. I was visiting Savannah, Georgia with my parents. We'd been there a few times before. We'd always like to take the ghost tours there. In case you've never heard or never been to Savannah, there's an old cemetery in the middle of one of the main squares. It was supposedly really haunted, but it gets locked at dusk because people performing satanic rituals there at night. Anyway, it was just before dark, and I was waiting with my dad to be picked up for a ghost tour. There was a group there of about 10 people, and we were all standing next to the cemetery. At this time, the cemetery was locked, and the only people allowed in was a walking tour that went through a few times. I was sitting next to the fence with my dad while looking around at the graves, and we just happened to be saying how neat it would be to actually see a ghost. At that second, my dad stood up and pointed. I looked in the cemetery, and next to a tree about 100 feet away were two people, in quotes, seemingly having a conversation. I jumped up and started trying to get a better view. There were lots of bushes where I was. I didn't have my good camera with me. All I had at the time was a cheap disposable camera, but I started snapping pictures anyway. As I watched, I could see it was a man and a woman. The man was dressed in old-fashioned 1800s style clothes with a jacket and a top hat. The woman was in a long black dress with a black veil and black umbrella. They looked like two people just standing there, but they couldn't have been. No one was allowed in. After they stood under the tree for a while, a tour group did come into the cemetery. They came in about 200 to 250 feet from the figures, but were all on the other side of the tree, so couldn't have been able to see them. The two figures actually stopped talking and looked at the group. She says, I know this is crazy, but bear with me. I'm bearing with you because I think it's a great story. She says, the two figures actually stopped talking and looked at the group. Then the man seemed to say something to the woman and started to walk away. I moved to get a better view of the man and kept my eyes on him the whole time he walked through the cemetery. And a second later, he vanished. He didn't step behind anything. There was nothing to go behind. He just vanished. After that, I looked to where the woman was. Then it got really weird. She had walked out from under the tree and was walking around the tour group. Now, that wouldn't have been so weird, except no one seemed to see her. She was standing less than a foot away from some people and getting inches from their faces, yet no one in the group acknowledged her. At the time, the tour guide I'd been waiting for arrived. A ghost tour, ironically enough. I didn't want to go, but I had to get on. The tour bus was actually a hearse with the top cut off, and I was on the side of the closest to the cemetery. As we drove by the front gate, I saw her one more time. She was sitting on a park bench near the front gate. I could see she had a long 1800s widow's dress with a black veil and black gloves. I couldn't see any of her skin, so I don't know what she actually looked like, but I was still amazed. Now, I want to let you know that besides me, the other people who saw the figures that I know of are my dad and a random journalist who was doing a story on the ghost tour. He had a much better camera and was freaking out trying to get pictures of them. But all the other people who were waiting didn't seem to notice them. I don't know why. To me, they were clear as day, but there was no way they were normal people. The pictures I sent aren't very good, but like I said, all I had was a cheap disposable camera. The first picture is when the woman walked through the group. On the right side of the picture, you can see people standing around a grave listening to some ghost story. Just to the left of the group, you can see what was the woman standing there. The picture came out badly as it was at an awkward angle, but I wanted to show you she was with the group and they weren't talking to her or looking at her at all. The rest of the pictures are from when the man and the woman were standing under the tree. I don't think anyone could say that there's not two people under the tree, but it's hard to make people believe that they were definitely not alive. I know what I saw, and my dad saw the exact same thing, so we're happy. But I've never seen a person disappear right in front of me. I hope you're able to read this. I'm sorry if it was too long, which it wasn't. I loved it. I thought it was a great story. She also says, I can't wait for your upcoming shows. You do a such great job. Don't change. Sincerely, Samantha. Well, Samantha, I have to say that is one of the best stories that anybody has sent to the show yet. Plus, I have to say the pictures you sent in are phenomenal. They are pricelessly great. I absolutely love them. It's some of the best pictures anybody sent to me as far as supposedly, and I hate to say supposedly, Samantha, don't take any offense to that, but supposedly of ghosts. Now, I don't want to say that maybe they could have had some kind of reenactment type of people, you know, from that time walking around just to give it some atmosphere. I doubt it. I don't think I've heard of any ghost tours putting, you know, actors in there, reenactment actors in there to be able to, you know, give it some ambiance or whatever. But anyway, you guys, I hope you enjoyed this, the story that Samantha sent in. And Samantha, thank you very much for sending that in. And thank you greatly for sending in the pictures. Now, I talked to Samantha. She wants me to go ahead and post the pictures. I'm going to go ahead and post them up there. You guys take a look at these pictures, analyze them, scrutinize them, do whatever you can. Now, I personally have looked at them. And there are definitely two people underneath that tree. Now, the first picture where she was saying that they were standing near the group, it's kind of hard to tell. I don't really get anything from that, but it could be a woman in a dress that you're seeing standing next to the people. But the other three pictures that I'll post, you can definitely see what is two people standing under a tree, and they're just black images. And they are completely full-formed in there. There's one picture where you can actually see the legs of the man standing there, and it looks like he has on a long dress coat of some kind. And they're just great pictures. I know it came from a disposable camera, but they are great pictures, and I really wish that you had a camera that was able to zoom in. I mean, to be able to get a closer picture of this, we would have been able to get a little bit more evidence as to what they really were and whether or not, you know, that you could have seen any details with them. And I wish you would have gotten a picture of her sitting on the bench. That would have been great. But either way, the pictures you sent in are great. So thank you, Samantha, for sending those in. And everybody, go take a look at it. And that was Samantha's story. Thanks for sending that in. I really do appreciate it again. Take a look at the pictures, you know, if you want to do some analyzing on them and, you know, see what you can come up with them. You know, if you happen to get anything, you know, zooming in on them, whatever, you know, shoot them to me and let me know. I'd love to see what you come up with. So anyway, those are some of the listener emails. And, you know, thanks to all you guys for sending those in. I really, really do appreciate it. The next thing that I wanted to take a look at here real quick, you guys, is something, well, it's not going to be real quick. It's actually going to take a little bit to get through, but it's courtesy of ProjectCamelot.org. And it's an interview they did with Sergeant Clifford Stone about how he went on missions to Vietnam for, you know, picking up for a crash recovery and how he helped an alien escape from custody. It's quite an interesting story. I will post links up to it so you guys can go listen to the whole interview yourself, which I suggest you do. I think it's a great interview. I'm not going to play the whole thing. I'm just going to play parts of it that I thought were interesting. So this first section, I'm going to let you guys go ahead and take a listen to, and you know, I'll give you my comments afterwards.
What do you want, a story that's believable, or do you want the truth? What's going on? How much does our government know? And when did they know it?
You were the interface between the government, or the military, and alien visitors. Would that be correct?
That'd be correct.
There's a price to pay when you start talking. And I don't want to go into that too much, because when you start reliving it, okay?
I see.
You have no idea what I'm seeing in my mind right now, just talking about the tip of the iceberg.
2-3 times I got out of the UFO field. But you want to tell you a little secret? You can't. There are people out there, and I'm one of them. It's not about money. God, I wish it was.
We will be going out into the cosmos, visiting other solar systems, other planets outside of our own. But when we do this, it's going to be that we're going to have a spiritual heightening. In other words, we're going to have to care what happens to the other guy.
All right. Now, in that, he said that he would like to, you know, that he wishes you could see what was in his mind's eye. And to be honest with you, I found that fascinating, because I would really like to see what he was thinking. I'd like to see what was in his head as far as the things that he's seen. You know, to see a living alien with people around, you know, that they got locked up somewhere or whatever, I think would be interesting enough. But I do agree with him that a spiritual awakening, you know, is needed in this world we live in, you know, with, you know, people and their religions fighting to claim that they're right. I mean, in my opinion, no religion is right completely. I mean, they might have certain aspects of it that are right. And a lot of people, they you know, that's why we have wars over religion, is that people think that their religion is right and yours isn't. You should believe what I believe, and if you don't, you're going to hell or whatever it is that you're going to go to, and that you're wrong, and that, you know, that they don't want to waste their time on you because you're not right, and you know, you're obviously, you know, evil if you don't believe what they think, or whatever. But anyway, I thought it was neat that he was talking about how, you know, if you could see what was in his mind's eye, because I really would like to know what's going through his head. But anyway, we'll move on to the next section here.
Do you mind telling us how you ended up in Roswell?
Well, the United States Army sent me here. I'm retired military.
Okay.
So as being retired military, you're always subject to recall.
Sure.
And you're always subject to possibly being asked things as a consultant.
Okay.
Well, I retired as a sergeant first class.
Now, was your title a clerk? I understand that was a cover story. Is this correct?
You actually had... You had a real life in the military. You had an actual mission. The only time that this other stuff came into play is when they had a UFO incident that was to occur, and you were in the immediate area of that.
And I can tell you, in 65 in Vietnam, there was a base camp there trying to open fire on a UFO. At the very minute they tried to do that, none of their weapons worked. All the electricity went out and remained so until after the UFO left. And I can tell you, from being in Vietnam for 4 years, and yes, it was 4 years, records reflect, I think, 37 months, but you add up the time of TDY that was over there, it's right at 4 years. TDY being temporary duty. Not having power on anything is very, very scary, and those are very, very tense moments.
And so he was a clerk, and they pulled him away from his normal duties to deal with UFO incidents. You know, I mean, me personally, I would think that maybe they would, you know, the military would have people that are doing this on a regular basis and not just kind of a part-time thing. You know, I just thought it was weird. I wouldn't think that. I mean, maybe it's kind of a cover-up to be able to say, okay, you know, your job duties are going after UFOs and that's all you're going to do. You know, they could be able to cover that up and be like, well, his job duties are this. He doesn't have, you know, we don't know what you're talking about. You know, maybe it's kind of a way of covering it up. But UFOs in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, I mean, what's that all about? I was trying to figure out, you know, I don't remember. It's the first time I've really ever heard anything about UFOs during the Vietnam War and in Vietnam. So did the UFOs cause their power to go out and for the guns to not work? And I understand the UFOs maybe make the power go out, but not making their guns work is... That's a true manipulation of a physical object when you aren't physically there. So I'd like to know how they did that. I mean, be able to turn power off, that I may be able to understand because, you know, of electricity not being a fully formed material object, if you know what I mean. But anyway, I thought it was interesting that it made the power go out, but more interesting that they, you know, that the guns weren't working, and that the fact that they would pull him away for UFO incidents from his normal job as a clerk. Anyway, let's just move on to the next section here.
Through me, they can pick up on everything that's there, and it's all old news to them.
Sure.
But they find some things interesting. Mm-hmm. And they'll find some things that are bemusing to them, because we're heading in the right direction, but we don't have the right I dotted. And if you know anything about mathematical formulas, we'll have things in reverse. But this right here sometimes scares you because you think, gee, is this a good, because you're being driven to do this.
So it's fascinating that, you know, we don't think of Vietnam and during the war as being a time that we would be also dealing with off-world cultures.
You know why? They truly were told to call them helicopters. You were in a war zone, so what you do is you go in and put old Occam's razor in there, and you eliminate to the lowest denominator. UFOs can exist. Let me rephrase that. UFOs is not a good term. Interplanetary conveyances cannot exist.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be something very earthly. NSA went ahead and would call UFOs UFOs when we were monitoring communications with the Soviet Union. But they always qualified that in hopes that with the initiation of the Sunshine Act, later to become the Freedom of Information Act, that they would not be subject to those acts by saying seven UFOs being reported by such and such location and site. But when they'd say seven UFOs, in parentheses, they would put probably balloons. Disregard the fact that in the one document I'm talking about, seven UFOs traveling at 1,700 miles an hour. Balloons can't do that.
Right.
And I always got bemused at that because even as a kid, I'd get bemused when people would say, I don't believe in ghosts. However, this happened.
Sure.
Tell a perfectly good ghost story. With me, I very early on knew that to deny the reality of UFOs and other phenomena occurs would be denying myself.
Interplanetary conveniences. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's an interesting way to put it for a UFO. And also, they said that some of the UFOs were traveling at 1,700 miles an hour, but probably balloons. I don't know if I've ever seen a balloon travel 1,700 miles an hour. I don't think I've ever seen a balloon travel 17 miles an hour, much less 1,700 miles an hour. So it makes you really wonder, how much is the government really covering up? Or are they covering up at all? Because they may not be covering up anything. Maybe this is all just one big societal hallucination that we're all going through right now. I don't know. I thought it was interesting. But let's move on to the next section here, which I personally found to be the most interesting of it all.
If they're saying that they are a guest, if our military is saying, well, this is one of our guests, they're not treating that entity as a guest. And what's happening is that you are feeling what that entity is feeling.
Uh-huh.
And one situation, I even helped one of them escape. And that right there was not telling them everything that was being said.
I'm curious what went on when you dealt with that. Was it, first of all, what kind of an entity was it? And I understand that they're being held prisoner. But how was it that you were able, and in fact, Dan Bursch talks about the same thing.
Well, I don't know whether it was a Stargate or what, but in order, on the inside where we had this entity, if we were to, and there's a tape that talks about this, which gives a whole lot more detail. But we went ahead, and if they were to try to extract this entity from inside where we were at, then there'd have been people killed. And this entity would not accept that. And you could feel what was going, you could feel what it felt. That's the best way to put it. And I'm trying to tell this without going into any real certain details. But I convinced the person that I always called the Colonel, and all throughout that's what I always called him. We went ahead and I said, you know, he needs to show me something, but everybody has to be cleared from here. It's just got to be me and him. And everybody went ahead, left. There was one spec fi that stayed there to help me, and I said, we've got to cut this screen fence back here, or this storm fence, and we can get in trouble for that. I says, yeah, I know, that's why I'm asking you to just drop off the bolt cutters and then beat feet. Well, he didn't. He went ahead and he cut the wires for me, and we got the entity outside. By the time they found out that we had the entity outside the perimeter, they went ahead and was very upset, and now they were even to the point where they even tried to shoot the entity. But the entity was now in a position where it was a bright, bright, bright light that came down, and I didn't even get to see the craft, and maybe it was because I just wasn't looking. But all of a sudden, this entity was there, then it wasn't. Then, of course, the guy I always called the Colonel, he went ahead and told me, well, I'd be court-martialed, then well, we're going to overlook it this time, but don't let that happen again. And, of course, I was chastising him. If they're supposed to be our guests, why were we treating them cruel and treating them as prisoners? As a matter of fact, even worse than prisoners. I have never seen either movie of the Manchurian Candidate.
Okay.
And the one thing that we had identified by the time I got out, 57 different species. And they were affectionately called the Heinz 57. I understand there's some phrase in one of those movies about that. I'd love to say there's only two or three races, or only four or five, or even one. I'd love to say that. But with what I know, if I change anything that I do know, then it's not reality. It's just going ahead saying things that people want to hear.
So he helped an ET escape. Now, personally, knowing how the military works, I would figure that the government would have made Mr. Stone either completely disappear, or they would have taken some kind of action against him. I wouldn't think that they would just give him a little slap on the wrist for helping an ET escape, an extraterrestrial, or whatever it was that he would help it escape. I would think that they would really take harsh actions against him for that. But, I mean, maybe not. Maybe he was that important to them that they needed him there, you know, to communicate. You know, he's, you know, an interceptor of this communication with aliens. I mean, maybe they needed him that badly that they couldn't really do anything. I mean, they can take away his papers that he has in his pocket that he wrote tic-tac-toe puzzles down on, but he can, you know, and they might, you know, get him shot for that, for taking papers, but he's going to be able to help an ET escape. I don't really know. I thought it was interesting, but to have 57 different species of aliens here on this planet, now that makes me wonder. 53 different species, or 57 different species of aliens. Now, is that because when the aliens landed here, they already had that many species with them? Or does that mean 57 different species of aliens have come to this planet? Now, if 57 different species of aliens come to this planet, it makes me wonder if maybe they're all connected in a way, or if maybe they're all in communication with each other. And we're more in the dark than what we know. You know, 57 different species, I mean, it makes me wonder if maybe these aliens all know about us, but we don't know anything about them. They're just keeping an eye on us, whatever. I don't know. Or maybe there's just, you know, this society that we live in is so uneducated and unknowledgeable about what's going on that they want to keep it that way. Maybe they think people are freak out. I don't know. All I know is that there's 57 different species of aliens here. I mean, seriously, though, do they all know each other? Did they? I mean, how could 57 different species all randomly find this planet that's two-thirds of the way out in the Milky Way that is in the random corner of the universe? I didn't really understand how that's possible, but maybe it is. I don't know. But I thought it was interesting. Again, I'll put up links for you guys to be able to listen to the whole interview. There's more, a lot more. It's about an hour-long interview that is a lot more than what I just played. That's just a fraction of it. So you guys go take a listen to it. I'll post up links for it so you guys can go download it and listen to it yourself. But if you got any comments on it, let me know what you think. All right, well, the next thing that I wanted to talk about is Mel's Hole. And I have another section of audio, but I wanted to read a little bit about this to you guys. Mel's Hole is a 9-foot in diameter, and this is courtesy of hecklerspray.com. It says, Mel's Hole is a 9-foot in diameter chasm in the earth found somewhere in the mighty U.S. state of Washington on the property of Mel Waters. What could possibly be so interesting about a hole? Mel's Hole is a 9-foot gaping hole that is supposedly over 80,000 feet deep. It's used as a dumping ground by many locals, and no matter how much garbage is thrown in there, it never amounts to a visible pile. Over the years, the locals have grown curious about the exact depth of the hole, and they've tested its depth a couple different ways. An entire refrigerator was thrown in at one point. It never was 1,500 feet long, was lowered in, and never reached the bottom. But I'm going to go ahead and play a bit of audio, and this audio is it's courtesy of, let's see here, turbo.peteronline.net. And I'll also put a link up to melshole.com, maps from Google, so you guys can see roughly where it's at, and the link to Heckler Spray article talking about Mel's Hole. But I wanted to play this section of audio for you guys. It's a 2002 interview on Coast to Coast AM. I thought it was an interesting interview. Mel had quite a few interesting things to say about, you know, how he tested out the depth of the hole. So you guys take a listen to this, and I'll be right back.
To bring everybody, just very quickly, the 101, you had a piece of property in Washington.
Yeah, out near Ellensburg, Washington, the center of Washington State, near the Manassas Ridge, which is sort of like the mountain range that runs along. Ellensburg is in the Kittitas Valley, and so you got a valley, you've got mountain ranges and ridges and so forth, and that's basically where the property is located out there.
What
happened with the property?
Well, yeah, I mean,
okay, we'll give you the nickel tour, as
thank
it were.
You. Thank you. Good.
Okay. Basically, this was back in '97, so this was 5 years ago, almost.
Yeah. Yes.
That I sent a fax to the show here, and basically I described what I had done about this hole and how I lowered some fishing line into it because, quite frankly, for years and years and years and years and years, people were dumping stuff into the holes. I'm talking refrigerators. I'm talking dead animals. My favorite thing to toss in there was TV picture tubes, but no matter what we tossed in there, we never heard anything hit bottom.
So you threw TV picture tubes down, but, I mean, I remember cows going down and...
Yeah, some people threw dead cattle out there. I had a little Mexican fellow that used to throw literally truckloads of tires down there.
And there was enough, the hole was big enough so that you could throw something down And you wouldn't hear it cascading off the side as it went down.
It was 9 feet across, and it had a retaining wall around the top of it, and the stone went down a bit. But as far as I can tell, as far as I could see,
no splash, no crash, no bang, nothing.
And it seemed to be, and it didn't look like it tapered. It looked, you know, from everything that I could see,
it looked as wide as far as you could see.
It was a hole.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe it's further than I could see. It tapered. I had no idea. What I was curious about is to find out if there was any water down there. You know, what the heck? So I lowered a big reel full of line into it, and had a roll of lifesavers on the bottom. The roll of the lifesavers was simply because if it hit water, the lifesavers would dissolve.
Absolutely.
It would melt. Sure. You know, it's an old fisherman's trick. So that's what I did. You know, I lowered down. I emptied a reel. I assume there's about 500 yards of line on this particular reel there.
Right.
I did that with another reel, so I connected them up there, and I get down to about 3,000 feet, and same result. And then finally, I get kind of nuts about the whole thing there, so I went and bought basically monofilament in wholesale quantities. It's the kind of stuff that they fill the fishermen's reels with down at the sporting goods stores. You see, they have monster reels.
Giant.
So, you know, basically I started lowering the stuff down there on a 1 pound lead weight into the hole.
By the way, did you have any help, or were you doing this all by yourself?
Well, the project was conducted by myself. I didn't have, you know, assistance or anything.
Yeah,
like
it was
that.
Your own property anyway, right?
It was my property. My wife was becoming estranged from me, so she wasn't hanging around or anything. I was just sort of out there at the property doing, you know, just to satisfy my own curiosity. And basically, at the point where I had reached 80,000 feet of line into the hole, and I had a little, for lack of a better word, I had a little widget that kept track of, it's just like a little, it's like a mechanical digital counter, but it was made for measuring how much line goes down, so I knew exactly how much line I'd put into the hole at that point.
Which was?
80,000 feet.
8,000
times 10, or 80,000, 80,000 feet. Something like 15 miles of line went into that hole.
All right. Well, you guys, I thought it was interesting that Mel isn't exactly telling the location of Mel's hole. And as far as, as far as anybody else knows, it's never been spoken out. Expeditions have been formed in an attempt to find it by gathering clues from Mr. Waters, but nobody's actually found it. Hecklerspray.com also says, another doubt-causing factoid worth considering is that the hole is resistant to having its photo taken, meaning, yeah, it's out there, but for some reason, no image is obtainable. So nobody's actually ever seen it. There's no living hole or no living picture of it. So if anybody ever comes across an actual picture of Mel's hole, I would love to see it. But I thought it was interesting. I have to say that having a hole that's that deep, you know, how did it form? How's it there? I mean, what would have made it that deep? I mean, it's not something people can't dig. I mean, I guess we could dig 80,000 feet, but something that wide, digging 80,000 feet is ridiculous. I mean, the man said that he put 80,000 feet worth of fishing line down this hole, and nothing ever happened. You know, it just never hit the bottom. I don't know. I thought it was interesting. It's 80,000 foot deep hole. And if anybody's got an opinion on Mel's hole, you know, shoot me an email, shoot me a voicemail, whatever. Let me know what you think about Mel's hole. All right. Well, the next thing that I want to talk about is courtesy of mysteriouspeople.com. And it's Cotswold's Mystery, Charles Wade and the Ghost of Snow's Hill Manor. Says Snow's Hill is one of the loneliest and most unspoilt villages in the Cotswolds. Its manor was owned by Winchcombe Abbey from 821 until the dissolution of the monasteries in 1539. When it passed to the crown, it was given to King Henry VIII's wife, Catherine Parr, as a gift. The main part of the house dates from around 1500 and was altered and extended by the 17th century. It's actually kind of a semi-derelict farm right now. It was bought and restored by a man named Charles Wade. And it was while he was in the army that Wade saw an advertisement for the sale of Snow's Hill Manor. And I'm guessing he bought it then. And there were no modern additions or alterations, and Wade deliberately disregarded the use of electricity and modern conveniences, preferring the subdued and atmospheric lighting of oil lamps and candles. When he commenced filling it with his extraordinary collection of objects and mechanical oddities, extraordinary clocks, bicycles, children's toys, and many other bizarre items which he had collected from various places around Britain. He didn't actually live in the manor house itself, but the old priest's house out in the courtyard. The small house, a priest lodging in monastic times, is the cottage in the west house of the manor. It says he was extremely fond of dressing up in old costumes from amongst his vast collections, and visitors to his strange Cotswolds manor, including Virginia Woolf, Graham Greene, and J.B. Priestley, were often persuaded to perform amateur dramatics in one of the rooms in the house called Dragon. Which is interesting. The names of the rooms in the house were chosen by Wade and usually bear some relation to their contents, decorations, or position in the house. Some of the names are like Seventh Heaven on the top floor, Meridian in the center of the house, and Dragon, named after the roaring fire that Wade would usually have burning that was probably the great fireplace, or that was in the great fireplace of the medieval hall. It was interesting that it says Wade seems to have a profound interest in magic and alchemy. In a private room at the top of the house known as the Witch's Garret, there was once a collection of objects connected to witchcraft, and the floor and one wall were decorated with various magical symbols. When the manor was given to the National Trust, this strange collection of magical objects was loaned to the Museum of Witchcraft, now at Boscastle in Cornwall. Amongst the items in the museum it still has is a large oak magician's chest from the 17th century. It's interesting. It says Wade spent a lot of time in the house organizing and restoring his incredible collection, and by the time he handed it over to the manor in 1951, he had amassed 22,000 items in a 2,000-piece costume collection. It's interesting to know what some people will collect. You know, I mean, come on. How in the world can you fit 22,000 items in a 2,000-piece costume in a house? I mean, I guess you can, obviously. But anyway, it's nothing real paranormal. I just thought it was interesting. So, you know, you guys go take a look at the Cotswolds mystery and all the crazy stuff that he had in the house. All right, well, the next thing that I wanted to talk to you guys about is courtesy of ReptilianAgenda.com. And it's Nevada's Gate to Hell. And I thought it was an interesting little short article. And I thought the site was pretty neat, too. There's a lot of interesting stuff on this site, reptilianagenda.com. But anyway, I'm going to go ahead and read this to you. It says, Nevada's Gate to Hell. Just down the road a piece from the Brothel Art Museum is another hellhole, Devil's Hole, located in Death Valley National Monument. It's not too much to look at, just a gash in the hillside surrounded by a chain-link fence. From a small platform, you can look down the abyss into a bathtub-sized pool at the bottom. The pool connects to a vast underground lake, the bottom of which has not been probed, which I'd like to know what's on the bottom of that, especially since it's underground. It makes you wonder what could be down there. It says that it's a bottomless pit. In it swims an endangered species of tiny prehistoric pupfish found nowhere else on the earth. Biologists believe that the pool may be connected underground to other small pools of pupfish located hundreds of miles away. UFO experts believe that Devil's Hole is connected to the underground caverns located beneath Area 51. Purportedly, reptilian aliens live in Devil's Hole and have emerged now and again. The Bible speaks of a bottomless pit that demons, or reptilian aliens, ascend out of, from Revelations 11:7. According to Vincent Bugliosi, Charles Manson searched for a bottomless pit in Death Valley in which he and his family could hide during Helter Skelter, and afterwards he would come forth as leader of the world. The Reverend Ethan Akers believes that the Devil's Hole is one of the portals of hell. He holds that this is no coincidence that this heinous hole is found so close to Nevada's brothels. For a whore is a deep ditch and a strange woman is a narrow pit, from Proverbs 23:27. Take Highway 95 towards Armagosa Valley, turn south onto Nevada Highway 160. When you see the flashing red lights, turn right on the ranch road towards the brothels in Crystal, Nevada. Proceed down the dirt road until you see a chain link fence on your right, Devil's Hole, Death Valley National Monuments. You can also go to ocweekly.com. They have some stuff in there on their archives about it. But I just thought it was interesting that we have Mel's Hole, which some people believe is a gate to hell, and then we have Nevada's Devil's Hole, which is another gate to hell, in quotes, that people say are there. Now, it's not surprising to me that a preacher would say something about, you know, that it's heinous and that it's no wonder it's found so close to Nevada's brothels and that the brothels are just a gateway to hell and that the devil's, you know, it's the devil's playground and he comes out of the hole and, you know, and comes out of devil's hole and goes to the brothels. And, you know, I just thought it was kind of interesting to know that there's something like this that has a hole down there that nobody's ever probed at all. I mean, how come we haven't gone down to the bottom of the of this underground lake? I mean, we had the technology to do it. So why don't we? I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, hell, we can go thousands and thousands of feet down in the ocean. But one thing that I thought was interesting is that the Devil's Hole is connected to the underground caves under Area 51. I don't know. I mean, maybe it is. It is in Nevada. But, I mean, are there caverns or there caves that big that could connect all the way there? I mean, I'm sure there probably is, but I haven't heard anything else about there being caverns under Area 51. Maybe the government's using them to their advantage. I don't know. But anyway, if you guys have any opinions on Nevada's gate to hell, you know, shoot me an email, voicemail, or something like that. Let me know. I'll post a link up to the article I just read, and you can search the site some more and, you know, go to the Reptilian Agenda main page. There's quite a bit of stuff there that I thought was pretty interesting that you guys can go take a look at. All right, well, the next thing I want to take a look at is courtesy of naturalplane.blogspot.com. And pardon me if I butchered the name of this, but it's the Koalinovi creature. Koalinovi. K-A-O-L-I-N-O-V-Y. Koalinovi. Anyway, it's a creature that is really, really teeny, no more than maybe a little bit bigger than your wrist to your tips of your fingers. But the article says a tiny body was discovered in the village of Koalinovi in Russia on August 13th, 1996. This is a current article, but the thing was found that long ago. I don't know why it took so long to get out. It says the village is located on the eastern slope of the Ural Mountains near the town of Kishtym in the Chelyabinsk Oblast. An oblast is the federal region administered by Russia. Okay. Due to poor or sensationalized press coverage at the time, the actual story of the discovery varies. According to an article published by the Pravda Online, the best account comes from Major Vladimir Bendlin, a former investigator with the police department of Kishtym. Bendlin claims that the police detained Vladimir Nerdinov during the summer of 1996 on suspicion of stealing some electrical wire. They said that he was carrying a bundle thought to contain some of the wire. When it was examined, the bundle was found to contain a red cloth with the remains of a tiny body inside. Police videotaped the cloth and the body. During the process, Bendlin casually commented on how much the body looked like an alien from a science fiction movie. Bendlin opened an investigation and approached the only physician he could find on duty later that day. Igor Uskov was a urologist with a local hospital. Uskov laughed when he heard Bendlin's alien explanation for the creature and countered with one of his own. The doctor was certain that there was a 20-week-old fetus and later confirmed the theory by having it examined by a prominent gynecologist. She also agreed that the body looked like a fetus and had added that it probably been expelled during a miscarriage or an illegal abortion. It says that things changed when Stanislav Samoshkin, chief of morbid anatomy at Kishtym Hospital, got involved. After performing an autopsy, which I don't know how you could perform an autopsy on a human body that's like 6-8 inches long. Anyway, it says that after performing an autopsy, he declared that the body to be neither human nor animal. His primary argument centered on the fact that a human skull consists of 6 bones, where this had 4. Although his opinion was in the minority, it set off a firestorm of publicity. It says, as a journalist and television crew from Japan arrived in town after offering cash for interviews, the original story morphed into something completely different. The new story involved a woman who found the creature alive in a cemetery in the outskirts of Koalinovi in the middle of the night. She had felt compelled to go to the cemetery by a voice in her head. The woman often went there during the day to gather flowers placed on graves. She said that the creature, she described the creature as a child that had large eyes, no ears, could not talk, and whistled to get her attention. She said that she brought the creature back to her apartment. I don't know. It says other paid witnesses said they came to her apartment and saw the gray-skinned creature alive. Because of her bizarre behavior and often outrageous claims, she was reported to the medical authorities, which took her into custody for her own safety. And then while she was there, she told authorities about a child in the house as they took her away. They ignored the warning and left with no one to feed the child. It died. And the neighbors failed to explain why they did not remove the child or make an effort to feed it. According to the Japanese television crew, the body was already missing when they arrived. However, they did not immediately speak to the police, just assumed someone in the town had it. So I'm guessing somebody did. The cloth that the guy, Nerdinov, claims that he had used to wrap the body in, he found it at the woman's apartment, and it only added to the convoluted mystery. After bloodstains originally found on that red cloth were tested and found to be human, a report of the Russian press in 2004 said that Moscow UFO researcher claims that more recent tests showed that the creature had nothing in common with humans. No information was provided to make clear that it was tested or how or by whom. So there's really a lot of missing information here and a lot of mixed information. I mean, who knows? But anyway, I thought they were really interesting. You guys should go take a look at this picture. It looks like just a miniature human body. If anybody has any info on this, let me know, because this is the first time I've seen the Koalinovy creature. So anyway, you guys go take a look at it. I'll post a link up to it. You guys go take a look at the pictures and, you know, like I said, let me know what you think about the Koalinovy creature. All right, well, the next thing I want to talk to you guys about is courtesy of FoxNews.com, and it's signs of brain surgery found in an ancient Greek skull. And I thought it was interesting. It says that Greek archaeologists say they unearthed evidence of what they believe was brain surgery performed nearly 1,800 years ago on a young woman who died during or shortly after the operation. Although references to such delicate operations abound in ancient writings, discoveries of surgically perforated skulls are uncommon in Greece. Site excavator Ionis Grekos said the woman's skeleton was found during a rescue dig last year in Viveria, a town some 75 kilometers west of Thessaloniki. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing those right. You guys know how I am with stuff like that. It says that we interpreted the find as a case of complicated surgery which only a trained and specialized doctor would have attempted. A bone expert who studied the find said that the skeleton belonged to a woman up to 25 years old who had suffered a severe blow to the crown of her head. The operation was apparently an attempt to save her life. He said the clearly defined shape of the hole left in the woman's skull was a sign of relatively sophisticated surgery. The discovery in Viveria appears to be similar to several others made in the other parts of the former Roman Empire. An expert on human skeletal remains, Simon Mays, said that the kind of operation dates back a long way. The earliest examples date back to about 5,000 years ago in Europe. In early examples, cruder holes were made in the skull by slowly scraping the bone away around the edges, but more precise instruments were used in Roman times. It says that the find attested to the social and medical sophistication of Viveria, which in the 3rd century AD, during the period of Roman rule, was one of Greece's most civic centers and the capital of the Federation of Macedonian Cities. The city boasted large public buildings, art workshops, and carefully laid out street network. So obviously, the Greeks and Romans were highly sophisticated. Obviously, I mean, the aqueducts, the plumbing and things like that. Plumbing for lack of better words, but I think that they really were a lot more sophisticated than what we think. I mean, this kind of lays claim to the fact that people had a lot of technology back then, a lot of knowledge. They knew what to do in cases like this. I mean, granted, the woman did die, but it's not like brain surgery and things like that have just been delegated to, you know, modern history. Anyway, I thought it was neat that you know, they were doing, you know, brain surgery that long ago. I mean, 1,800 years ago, It's a long time, so it's pretty interesting. I mean, it makes you wonder if they were doing brain surgery 5,000 years ago, what could they have been doing 10,000 years ago? I mean, it's interesting to say the least. So you guys go take a look at the brain surgery found in an ancient Greek skull, and if you got any opinions on it, let me know what you think. All right, well, the next thing I want to talk about is courtesy of paranormal.about.com and is shadow people stories, and supposedly the scariest ones of them all. And for those of you who don't know what a shadow person is, shadow people may be the most commonly seen apparitions. Countless people have reported catching sight of them. Most often, they are just detected as fleeting images out of the corner of one's eye, or perhaps we can dismiss many of these instances as real shadows or optical illusions of one kind or another. There are many other plausible cases, however, in which these shadow entities have been seen straight on for several seconds or even minutes. What are they? Who knows? I mean, honestly, are they dark ghosts, beings from some other time or dimension? Are they ourselves? What are they? And they can be terrifying to those who see them. As you'll read in these frightening cases, this one is called "It Wanted the Papers." It says in 1983, the wife of Doyle, a geologist, encountered one of these shadow peoples in their home near Olathe, Kansas. Its appearance followed that of another spirit, a vaporous white form. Doyle says his wife was home alone in the house one September evening. He said that she was headed down the hallway when she stopped, feeling a slight chill in the air. Almost immediately, she observed a wispy white shape, that of a woman in flowing white apparel, drifting from my office into the master bedroom. This apparition seemed to look briefly at her as it passed away. But then, something else made its appearance. From the master bedroom, into which the wispy woman in white had disappeared, emerged a very solid and very ghastly apparition. This thing was a slow-moving black skeleton form, like some hideously animated charred corpse. It did not drift, but walked slowly into my office, not seeming to be aware of my wife. You would think that this thing would have terrified her, but she said she felt no unease whatsoever, despite its frightening appearance. In fact, she advanced to the office door and looked in. The light was on, and this thing was standing at my desk with its back to her, looking down. She said it was reaching out with a bony black hand at the papers on the desk, as if it were profoundly interested in those papers. She stood transfixed as it then slowly turned, as if aware of her presence, to face her. She said it seemed to have remnants of charred clothing clinging to its body. It then looked back at her, its faceless skull devoid of any emotion, malevolent or otherwise. Its eye sockets were black and empty. She had no thought that it meant her harm was evil, that it simply vanished like a TV screen being snapped off. That's kind of creepy. I've never seen a shadow figure that looked like a charred skeleton. That's crazy. The next one is called The Digging Shadow Man. There are other stories in which these shadow people seem to appear with a purpose. Sometimes they seem curious about the people they are visiting. Reiner recounts what happened to his brother when he was 12 years old. One night, while everyone was fast asleep, my brother heard the shutter of this window open. He peeked from under his covers and saw a hand coming through the shutter. He closed his eyes, thinking that it was a dream, but then he looked again. There was now a figure of a man inside his room. This figure was so dark that even our pitch-black room, his outline was clear. Terrified, he screamed and switched on the nightlight beside his bed. The dark figure seemed startled and leapt out the small window. This reaction by the figure indicates that it was well aware of its surroundings. But what did it want? A year later, it returned and behaved very mysteriously indeed. This time, the figure was already in our room. The thing walked across our room and studied my sleeping self and our youngest brother. He then went in between our beds and started digging with what my brother explained as a pick-like tool. The sight frightened him, and he again switched on the lights and shouted for me to wake up, but this time the figure didn't leave. It stopped its digging and just stared at him. Seeming to walk towards his bed, I woke up from his screaming, and just as I looked towards him, I saw the dark figure. It looked back at me, then looked at my brother. It jumped out of the shutter just as my brother said it did before. Interesting. That's creepy, man. Just see it sitting there digging in between your beds is just, that just would creep me out. Shadow people aren't just creatures of the night. Consider Victor's sighting on November 1st, 2003. At 8 a.m., he was in the kitchen pouring himself some coffee when he saw the shadow person actually materialize on his backyard patio. The smoke stepped aside from the post and formed into a human shape. I could see the torso from above the groin, no legs, the head and right arm. I couldn't see a face, and the torso didn't appear to be clothed. The whole thing was still very smoky, fluid, and almost had a shimmery sparkle to it. The next second, the apparition actually straightened its head from a downward position like somebody standing at attention. I saw the shoulder snap into place and we stood and stared directly at each other for a split second. His whole body jolted like he was shocked that I was looking at him. It was a very human reaction. Imagine how your body reacts when somebody surprises you. He turned sideways and raised his arm like he was running. He scooted very quickly back towards the patio post. At the time, he appeared to be running. His body almost seemed to be reverting back to smoky mist shape. This is really weird. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of other stories here for you guys to go take a look at. I just thought I'd read a couple of those experiences to you. I thought they were really creepy. I mean, to be honest with you, a charred, skeleton-like black figure. I don't know if I could have been as calm as that one woman was in that story. I think I might have actually had at least a heart rate going and, you know, been a little freaked out by it. Especially if it would have come walking towards me. If it just disappeared, it wouldn't have been all that bad. But I'd be freaked out. I don't know about y'all. But anyway, if anybody out there has any experiences of their own with shadow people, feel free to send them in. I'd love to be able to hear them and share them with everybody else. But if you have any opinions on shadow people, good or bad, negative, positive, whatever, you believe it or you don't, you know, let me know. All right, well, the next thing I wanted to talk about is courtesy of environment.newscientist.com, and it's called Curious Cloud Formations Linked to Quakes. It says, can unusual clouds signal the possibility of an impending earthquake? That's the question being asked following the discovery of distinctive cloud formations above an active fault in Iran before each of two large earthquakes occurred. Geophysicist Guanming Guo and Ben Wang of Nanyang Normal University in Henan, China, noticed a gap in the clouds in satellite images from December 4th that precisely matched the location of the main fault in southern Iran. It stretched for hundreds of kilometers, was visible for several hours, and remained in the same place, although the clouds around it were moving. At the same time, thermal images of the ground showed that the temperature was higher along the fault. 69 days later, on February 22, 2005, an earthquake of magnitude 6.4 hit the area, killing more than 600 people. In December 2005, a similar formation again appeared in the clouds for a few hours. 64 days later, an earthquake of magnitude 6 shook the region. Guo and Wang, the two geophysicists, suggested an eruption of hot gases from inside the fault could have caused water in the clouds to evaporate. Another idea is that ionization may have been involved. Friedman Freund of the NASA Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California, recently demonstrated that when rocks are squeezed, positively charged ions form in the air above. The trouble is that the ions usually help to form clouds, not dissipate them. The authors say that if recognizable cloud formations precede large earthquakes, they could be used for prediction, but other seismologists are skeptical. There is no physical model to explain why something would suddenly occur 2 months before an earthquake and then shut off and not occur again, which is true. Very true. I mean, I would think that something like this would happen in a closer time frame than what it is. I mean, one of them was 69 days in between the cloud formation and the earthquake. Another was, 64 days or something along those lines in between when it happened and when the earthquake happened. So I'm a little skeptical as to whether or not it can be used to predict earthquakes, but I do think that there are natural signs out there that we as humans can't tap into to be able to recognize when something like this is going to happen. I mean, I've heard stories about how animals will start acting funny before an earthquake happens or before, you know, a major event happens. I would think that they're able to tap into something that we can't sense as humans, that they have some kind of extrasensory perception as far as that's concerned to be able to pick up on this stuff. But anyway, if anybody has any ideas on how cloud formations or anything like that can be linked to earthquakes or how any natural occurrence is preceded by some kind of natural warning system of some kind. Anyway, you know, nature is a strange thing that I think we still don't fully understand. But anyway, if you guys got any ideas on that, you know, let me know what you think.
They tap into your bloodstream like tiny little vampires. They hack into your nervous system like you were a walking computer network built just for them. They flood your body with chemicals that cause fear, paranoia, and psychotic rage. It's a disease that thinks. It's a disease that talks. And if you're lucky, you die before it becomes a disease that walks. On April Fool's Day, experience the horror thriller novel, Infected, the major hardcover release from number one bestselling author, Scott Sigler, creator of the free podcast novels, Earthcore, Ancestor, and Nocturnal, available April 1st, online and in bookstores everywhere. Free audio chapters of Infected are available at scottsigler.com and infectednovel.com. The disease kills you slowly if the cure doesn't kill you first.
Okay, well, the next thing I wanted to talk about is courtesy of Canada.com. And it's the Swedish spruce, maybe the world's oldest living tree. And I thought it was interesting. You guys can actually take a look at the tree. There's quite a little bit of an article here. It says that in Stockholm, scientists have found a cluster of spruces in the mountains in western Sweden, which at an age of 8,000 years, may be the world's oldest living tree. The hardy Norway spruces were found perched high on a mountainside, where they have remained safe from recent dangers such as logging, but exposed to the harsh weather because of the conditions in the mountain range. Carbon dating of the trees carried out at a laboratory in Miami, Florida, showed that the oldest of them first set root 8,000 years ago, making it the world's oldest known living tree. That, according to Leif Coleman at Umeå University in... not sure where that's at. Anyway, it says California's Methuselah tree, a Great Basin bristlecone pine, is often cited as world's oldest living tree with a recorded age between 4,500 and 5,000 years. Two other spruces also found in the course of climate change studies in the Swedish country of Dalarna were shown to be between 4,800 and 5,500 years old. Although a single tree trunk can become at most about 600 years old, the spruces had survived by pushing out another trunk as soon as the old one died. Rising temperatures in the area in recent years have allowed the spruces to grow rapidly, making them easier to find in the rugged terrain. I thought it was interesting that something can live for that long. I thought it was interesting that a tree could live to be 8,000 years old. And, maybe there's things on this planet that are older than that. Who's to say? Maybe the tree's only 500 years old and the carbon dating doesn't work correctly. I still have my issues with carbon dating, even though science has proven it to be real. But I think there's ways of contaminating it that might give you a wrong idea on something's age. But, maybe it is true. Maybe it is 8,000 years old. Either way, I think it's interesting that, that anything can live to be 8,000 years old. So... anyway, that's the world's oldest tree in Sweden. So you guys let me know if you have any ideas, questions, comments, feedback, whatever on the world's oldest tree.
Hey gang, Jay Emmett from the Obscurities Podcast with a special message for all you podcast fanatics out there. On Saturday, June 14th, we will be hosting the first annual Big Hair Bash Against Cancer in an effort to raise money for the American Cancer Society. Now, we realize not everyone out there in Podland can attend the fundraiser, but that doesn't mean you can't help. During the entire month of May, leading up to the Big Hair Bash, every penny that is donated to our show via our website will go to the cause. Just go to www.obscure80s.com and hit the donate button on the homepage. That's www.obscure80s.com. Go to the website. Show your support. Because together, we can make a difference. Thank you, and stay awesome.
All right, well, the next thing that I wanted to talk to you guys about is courtesy, again, of naturalplane.blogspot.com, and it's an old video. It's old black and white video, and it's with Donald Kehoe, and I thought it was an interesting video. You guys should go take a look at it, but I'm going to go ahead and read part of the article here. It says, on March 8, 1957, former Marine Air Corps pilot Major Donald Kehoe, director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomenon, or NICAP, was interviewed on national television by the ABC reporter Mike Wallace. Through the 1950s, Major Kehoe was conducting ongoing UFO investigations and public inquiry into the existence of UFOs. Kehoe appeared on television regularly to discuss the subject of flying saucers and the need for complete government disclosure. CBS TV pulled the mic on him when he appeared on the Armstrong Circle after he began to speak about congressional hearings into UFOs. In this interview, archived at the Harry Ransom Center in the University of Texas in Austin, Major Kehoe talks to Mike Wallace about the United States Air Force cover-up of UFOs, relates reports of UFO sightings by professional airline and military pilots, discusses various theories explaining UFOs, exposes official government cover-ups employing scientists as debunkers, reveals the existence of Robertson panel report, as well as AFR 200-2, which I'm not sure what that is, and expounds on the possibility of extraplanetary war in the future. So anyway, it's an interesting video. You guys go take a look at it, and if you got any feedback on it, let me know what you think, because I thought personally it was very, very, very interesting, especially considering that this video was, what, over 60 years old? So anyway, you guys go take a look at it and let me know what you think. All right, well, the next thing that I wanted to talk about is courtesy of news.yahoo.com, and it's a choir director who's bringing prayers for lower gas prices to San Francisco, which he needs to bring it everywhere, because personally I'm getting sick of paying the prices we have to pay right now. Anyway, it's not quite as bad as what it is over in Europe. But anyway, the article says a choir director who hopes prayer can bring down high gas prices is trying out his approach at some of the costliest pumps in the country. Rocky Twyman of Washington, D.C. came to San Francisco over the weekend to stage a prayer in at a Chevron station. He also is calling on churchgoers to ask for God's intervention where he says politicians have failed. Gas costing $4 a gallon or more has become common around the San Francisco Bay Area. The 59-year-old Twyman says people praying for cheaper fuel should also walk more and use carpools. Twyman also works as a community organizer and public relations consultant. He has led campaigns to nominate Oprah Winfrey for the Nobel Peace Prize and to encourage African Americans to donate bone marrow, which are all good things. Whatever, that's great stuff. I think you should donate bone marrow and blood and all that stuff, which I think is good, you know, help people out. But I thought it was interesting that people were paying for cheaper gas prices. I mean, to be honest with you, if you think God really cared about gas prices, he'd make them low everywhere. He'd get rid of all this oil money that goes around. Anyway, we won't get into that because that brings in politics and religion, and I'm not about to go there. I just thought it was interesting that, you know, people are praying for cheaper gas. All right, well, the next article that I wanted to talk about is courtesy of paranormalnews.com, and it's a winged creature in Angol in Chile. Says that Mr. Oscar Solar Valdebenito, I'm sorry if I'm messing that up, it says he's a sergeant with the Carabineros, which I'm not sure what that is, but was performing his duty as a security guard in the Preventive Custody Center in the city of Angol on Friday, April 28, 2000. Now, this article was posted in, on the 22nd of April. So, anyway, it says that Mr. Solar was alone and was making rounds of the construction site's interior. Once he returned to the guard shack at the southern side using a passageway located in the back, he noticed the presence of an animal standing 1.2 meters tall. 1.2 meters. That's interesting you can get that accurate of a height measurement when you're not even there, like, at it measuring it. You gotta do it from a distance. Says average complexion with a small head in proportion to the rest of its body. The creature sat on top of a metal pole ending in four luminaries, standing some 8 meters tall. The animal landed at the very same time that the watchman turned his attention to the site. Solar was able to see the lights go out and the pole shake as a result of the creature's descent. The estimated weight of this strange being was some 40 to 50 kilograms. According to the eyewitness, anyway. Its head featured two medium-sized ears, sideways and pointing upwards, with round tips pricked up like those of a police dog. Two long wings with pointed ends emerged from its shoulders. It never folded its wings, keeping them unfurled like a vulture in the sun. According again to the eyewitness account, he saw no feathers, only a kind of velvety skin, which was dark gray and black in color. He was unable to make out the face, which if he saw that much detail and was able to measure, he should have been able to make out the face. Anyway, the wings extended to the creature's lower body, where he could also see two legs. A pair of stubby arms could also be seen under the head. The witness was accompanied by four dogs, a beige female dog in the lead. Apparently, the winged animal pounced on the dog, but these took off running and howling in a southward direction, abandoning the site. It says five or six youths coming down the north, coming down from the north along the railroad tracks that go beside the site, also took off running when they saw what was going on. The witness explained that he was standing some 30 meters from the pole, which 30 meters is a good amount of, that's a good amount of distance. He said that he didn't manage to move or turn on his flashlight. He said he recalls having heard a sharp, loud squawk as the animal landed on the pole. Judging by the tone of the squawk, it was reminiscent of a loudspeaker's crackle. The animal eventually landed on the ground after making a flight in a gentle curve. It landed on a conical pile of dirt. After the dogs took off, it flew off with two gentle flaps of its wings flying over a 3-meter wall above which five wires are suspended, providing light to another street lamp in the corner. The creature never came close to touching them. The animal came within 10 meters of the eyewitness's position. Its descent to the ground left prints on the mound of dirt. The eyewitness managed to see three thin holes and then fenced them off, but they were erased and destroyed the next day, which is typical and sad at the same time. The witness confessed that when the animal was close to him, flying off with a gentle beat of its wings, he was unable to control a bowel movement, a fact that he tried to keep confident on account of the customary jokes that tend to emerge in such cases. So, in other words, he crapped his pants. The young men who were also walking along the train tracks were never located, so nobody ever got to know what they were doing, although efforts are underway to figure out who they were and get any type of evidence from them. But anyway, I guess the guy got the crap scared out of him, literally. But I thought it was an interesting story. It almost sounds as if this guy had experienced either what would be the Chupacabra in a way, I guess, or maybe even something like the Mothman. I don't know, but I thought it was an interesting story. So you guys go take a look at it. And, you know, if you got any ideas on the winged creature of Chile, let me know. I'd love to hear about it. I thought it was interesting anyway. All right, well, the next thing that I wanted to talk about, I personally thought was hilarious because I've seen them before, and this article is courtesy of Reuters, or Reuters, or however you want to call it, reuters.com. And it's Florida. They're going to ban the fake testicles that they put on vehicles. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that, but anyway, the article says Senate lawmakers in Florida have voted to ban the fake bull testicles that dangle from trailer hitches of many trucks and cars throughout the state. Republican Senator Cary Baker, a gun shop owner from Eustis, Florida, called the adornments offensive and proposed the ban. Motorists would be fined $60 for displaying the novelty items, which are known by brand name like Truck Nuts, and resemble the south end of a bull moving north. The Florida senator voted last week to add the measures to a broader transportation bill, but it's not included in the House version. In a spirited debate laced with doubt, with double entendres, Senate lawmakers questioned whether the state should curtail freedom of expression in vehicle accessories. Critics of the ban included the Senate Rules Chairman, Senator Jim King, a Jacksonville Republican whose truck sported a pair until his wife protested. The bill's sponsor doubted it would succeed. It's probably not going to make it through the process. It won't be much of a story in a few days, which I thought was really funny. I mean, granted, if you try to say that you can't put truck nuts on your truck, you know, show that your truck got some balls, you know, if you can't do that, then that's basically you're taking away your freedom of expression here in the United States. You have the freedom of expression, which means you can do things like that, and you shouldn't be held against you. You know, but people here in the States are too PC, in my opinion. But anyway, I think truck nuts, I don't even know if you've ever seen them or not. For any of those of you guys who have seen them, you know how funny they are. Or offensive, I don't know. Personally, I think they're hilarious. But for those of you who don't know what they are, they basically just look like a pair of testicles hanging from the back of a truck, which I think was hilarious that these have offended these people to the point where the Senate is trying to get it made illegal. Anyway, and you have to pay $60. Hell, I'd probably pay $60 just one time just to be able to say I got a ticket for my truck having nuts. Anyway, I thought it was interesting. If you guys got any opinions or, you know, if you're offended by it or if you think it's funny for vehicles to have truck nuts, let me know. I'd like to hear about it. Anyway, let's move on. The last thing that I wanted to talk about is courtesy of AmericanChronicle.com, and it's a visit from the devil. This story is kind of long, but I'm going to go ahead and read it anyway because it's not too bad. But anyway, it's a living nightmare. And it says, and I'm going to read this. I guess it was written from the girl or the woman who actually wrote it. So I'm going to read it exactly the way that it is. It says, "Hi, my name is Dawn, and I have a very scary story that still haunts me to this day. It was long ago when I was about 12 or 13, and we lived in Wallensburg, Colorado. We lived in the almost desert-like area on about 45 acres of land and lived in a double-wide trailer in the middle of nowhere. My brother and I had just got home from school. I went into my room and laid down for a bit. When I woke up, it was dark out. We didn't have much of an outside light, for our house at the time ran off of a gas generator. It says, just as I was walking into the living room from the kitchen, my dog was woken up for reasons unknown. He went to the front door, bowed his head, and started to growl violently. It was for the first time I was ever scared of my dog. He went from the front door to the kitchen window, which was over by the kitchen sink, placed his paws in the counter, and you could see the hair on his neck stand up. My mom and I looked at each other speechless outside of what the hell was wrong with him. At that point, I really thought he was going to jump through the window, but he didn't. He went to the front door. My mom made the mistake of opening the front door, and he bolted out the door. All of a sudden, we heard something that very much sounded like a dog fight. My mom turned on the front porch, and sure enough, he was fighting with something that looked like a dog. Mom yelled for Trooper, the name of the dog, to come inside, and as he turned to come inside the house, the animal blocked his way. She really got scared and went for the 12-gauge shotgun we had at the time. Trooper, the dog, came inside, and when she turned around, there stood this dog coming straight for the door. She shot at the dog, hitting him in the side, and he hit the ground. Now, they didn't shoot their dog, they shot the dog-looking creature that was, you know, fighting with their dog. My mom turned and looked at me, and at the time, the dog got up off the ground and looked at me. As me and the dog locked eye contact, my mom grabbed the shotgun again, hitting the dog in the stomach as he lunged for me. I was so scared, I couldn't move. We figured two blows with a 12-gauge shotgun would put the animal in the grave, but it didn't. Once again, the animal got up and took another blow to the stomach. As the dog lay there, my mom says it looked like the animal was pushing its guts back into its stomach and got up and ran off. The next day, we went out to find three big puddles of blood in our yard. We searched for hours and hours to find the body of this animal, but never did. As we went back to the house, my mom said that whatever the animal wanted, it wanted it with you. Why? I told her I don't know. The most scariest words she ever said to me was, "Do you feel like you just got a visit from the devil?" Anyway, it's the end of the story. I wish it was more than that. It kind of stops abruptly, but it was written by Dawn. You can visit trueparanormaltales.com, and you know, you'll be able to read more of the tales of the paranormal and strange. So anyway, I thought that was interesting that they shot this thing three times and it started shoving its guts back inside of its stomach and ran off. You know, what would that have been? What would the point of that? I mean, was it trying to go for the daughter? Was it trying to go for one of them? What was the point of it all? Anyway, I thought it was interesting. I'll post up links to everything that we've talked about in the show today, you guys. But I'm going to have to start wrapping this up. We'll take one more break and we'll close out the show. right. Well, you guys, I appreciate you coming and listening to the show again today. It's time to close the show out. I appreciate all the support everybody's been giving me. You know, if you like the music in the show, it's courtesy of Iota Promenet, and you can find them at iotaalliance.com. There's links on the site to download all of the songs from tonight's show and all the previous songs from all the other shows. And there's links there if you like the music so much that you can actually go and buy the music. Again, it's courtesy of iotaalliance.com. And if you like, I'd love to know where you're listening from. You can go to frapper.com, sign the Frapper map, or you can go to the link on the left sidebar, the 13skulls.com. There's a link for the Frapper map there. You can also, if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to be able to get up in the rankings in Podcast Alley. If you would, give the show a vote at podcastalley.com. You can search the 13 Skulls and find it there, or you can go to the link on the left sidebar, the 13skulls.com. There's a link for the Podcast Alley voting link there. And, you know, if you got any comments, ideas, requests for topics, comments, experiences, anything like that, you want to write it out or send me an MP3, any type of audio or whatever, I can accept just about any format, send it to the13skulls@gmail.com, and that's THE13SKULLS@gmail.com. Don't forget to put the THE in the beginning. It's the13skulls@gmail.com. If you want to tell it to me, you want to call the show, the phone numbers are 206-338-2205, or locally here in the DFW area is 817-986-0019. So again, you guys, I really do appreciate you coming and taking a listen to the show again. I've had a lot of fun doing this show, and I appreciate all the support everybody's given me. Like I said, any of the topics that we talked about, I'll post links to them. All the pictures, I'll post those up too. Thanks for everybody for writing in, listening to the show. Again, as usual, I hope you guys have a great day, night, week, weekend, whatever it is that you're listening to the show. And as usual, I will talk to you guys again on another day.